what's happened over the last year has been a systematic effort to essentially dismantle the opposition.
Cambodia counts ballots in widely expected win for its ruling party. It's Monday, July 30th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Be sure to join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, North Korea hands over remains believed to be U.S. servicemen. Finding homes for Taiwan's stray animals. Questions for Chinese immigrants in New York. An ancient fish diet. And e-gaming. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Cambodians headed to the polls Sunday for an election in which the only viable alternative party has been banned. That's helped the country's prime minister of more than three decades to extend his reign even longer. There was little doubt that the country's ruling Cambodian People's Party would win the ballot in a landslide following the dissolution of the Cambodian National Rescue Party late last year. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about the election with Sopal Ear, Assistant Professor of Diplomacy and World Affairs at Occidental College in Los Angeles.
We all expected this outcome given how the election was set up and how the ballot looked.
How did it look, and why is Hun Sen able to get away with this? What has transpired?
Well, the ballot did not include the main opposition, Cambodian National Rescue Party, which won 44% of the vote in 2013 and 43% in commune elections in 2017. And he's able to do that, the Prime Minister of Cambodia is able to do that because he has all the levers of government, including the judiciary, to launch attacks and to dissolve the main opposition party, which is what happened last year. What's happened over the last year has been a systematic effort to essentially dismantle the opposition, shutter the media, independent media that would have covered negative stories or things that the government would have done that would have been suspicious, and to essentially silence all critics. So even independent observers like the National Democratic Institute, which operated for many years in Cambodia, was expelled. Radio Free Asia hasn't been able to operate in Cambodia since that time. And so it's essentially going down a list of enemies that he's had that he needs to get rid of, and he got rid of them.
So what happens now?
The status quo of more of the same could continue. There is that possibility that he would still feel insecure and need to somehow further control conditions around him. I think there's also the possibility, frankly, that he might decide that having secured 5 years, it's time to look at transitions and perhaps moving one of his sons to become prime minister while he remains, of course, in the background as, say, minister mentor like Lee Kuan Yew was, or maybe taking the cue from Myanmar as a state counselor or something like that, as Aung San Suu Kyi is. But I think the idea here is that there's going to be obviously a need to look at transitions. And then there's also the very remote possibility that having gotten 90 possibly percent of the National Assembly seats, 90%, that they'll feel now able to clean up all the corruption that has made Cambodia a world leader in that area and certainly the most corrupt country in Southeast Asia. So one hopes, maybe it's wishful thinking, that they'll wake up and decide that it's time to do all those reforms they promised or said they were going to do years ago.
Do you think that is a definite possibility?
It's certainly not 0%, but I don't think it's very likely. I'm not in the camp that believes that old dogs can learn new tricks. There's a way in which things have been done in Cambodia that has essentially made it very difficult, I think, to suddenly stop doing those things.
What does this do on an international scale as far as number one, Asia is concerned, and number two, the rest of the world, including the United States and China?
For Asia, it's not a great sign. I mean, I think for Malaysia, the recent election there gave people hope that there could be change after many decades of single-party rule. With respect to the United States, I would imagine sanctions of the targeted nature first, but possibly later more from the European Union in terms of trade sanctions, probably the suspension of everything but arms, which is their version of a generalized system of preferences, trading preferences. And then from Australia, I think there may be action on asset freezes because a number of senior government officials have been discovered to own huge multi-million dollar mansions and companies. For China, I think it's certainly enacted its own version of the Monroe Doctrine, which is to look at Southeast Asia as its own backyard and for it to essentially increase its sphere of influence in the region. I think to the worries of many Southeast Asian countries, if not the leadership, then at least the people living there. I know that in Cambodia, the beach city of Sihanoukville with its deep water port is now considered completely Chinese-controlled with so much real estate and hospitals catered to the Chinese that Cambodians have to go get health care in Kampot province instead. So there's a sense that they're losing control over their own country. They're not masters of their domain anymore. And I guess the worry would be that if more people feel this way, how is the leadership answering to those worries that that they're no longer in control of their own country, that there are portions of the country that are completely overrun by Chinese tourists, visitors, medical tourists, and so on, and that they need to regain some semblance of control.
So Paul Ear, Assistant Professor of Diplomacy and World Affairs at Occidental College in Los Angeles, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find currently trending on voanews.com. Cambodia's ruling party in expected landslide election win. Deadly quake strikes Indonesian tourist island. Japan's latest weather disaster, Typhoon Jongdari. Evacuations ordered as Vanuatu volcano emits clouds of ash. U.S. bottom line on North Korea and Iran complete denuclearization. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. And as always, we invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A U.S. military plane brought back 55 cases of remains North Korea says are of U.S. service members killed in the Korean War more than six decades ago. The transfer was part of the agreement made last month between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump during their meeting in Singapore. VOA Seoul correspondent Brian Padden spoke with Sarah Williams about the repatriation of the remains of the American service personnel.
This has been anticipated since the Singapore summit. This was part of the summit agreement between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. This was part of the trust-building measures I think they agreed upon to at the end of the summit to help work towards the whole denuclearization agreement. There are, I think, over 7,000 remains of former soldiers that are still in the possession of North Koreans. And today they've returned about 55 Americans or the remains of those Americans who fought during the Korean War. They were picked up very early this morning by a military aircraft and returned to Osan Air Base south of Seoul. There will be a ceremony next Wednesday to receive them and to commemorate the return, and there will also be some DNA testing later to make sure that the remains are actually the Americans who were missing at the end of the Korean War.
Well, Brian, as you said, though, there still are potentially thousands more remains left of U.S. soldiers in North Korea. Is it known at this point whether there'll be further repatriation of those remains?
One of the frustrations in dealing with North Korea, whether it's about denuclearization or family reunions or in this aspect, the return of these remains, there's not a lot of information shared. A few weeks ago, I think the U.S. sent people up to receive them, and they did not come a few weeks ago. So they're getting partial remains. I spoke to one analyst earlier in the week who said part of the problem is that the North Koreans themselves don't know where all these remains are at the present time. So it's going to take a lot of work and effort for them to collect them from different sites around the country and inventory and confirm and bring them to the border to bring them back to the U.S. But it is also the case we are being told by other analysts that, you know, this is part of the game that North Korea plays. They make promises, but they dole out small portions at a time in hopes of trying to gain some sort of advantage in future negotiations, maybe get some sort of compensation in the future.
Seoul correspondent Brian Patton speaking with VOA's Sarah Williams. Happening now in Asia, a 6.4 magnitude earthquake has hit Indonesia's Lombok Island, killing at least 10 people, injuring 40. The shallow 7-kilometer deep earthquake hit the popular tourist destination early Sunday, sending people into the streets and open fields to avoid collapsing buildings. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're starting off a brand new week, and we're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Taiwan's legislature banned mercy killings of stray dogs and cats in 2015 following strong protests from animal rights groups who opposed the population control measure. The ban took effect in March 2017. More than a year later, shelters have reached maximum capacity, and there's growing pressure for humans to find ways to care for the strays. Ralph Jennings tracks down some of Taiwan's abandoned animals and finds out how the island is coping with the challenge.
These dogs are abandoned by their owners. They have been in the shelter for weeks. No one wants to adopt them. They would have been euthanized in the past. Now they're given a second chance. It used to be that many unwanted pets dropped off by their owners and strays picked up off the streets were killed by euthanasia at shelters like this one to prevent overcrowding. But that practice has now been banned by popular demand. Government shelters used to kill thousands of dogs each year. Now staff at shelters like this one, with 200 dogs, located in the suburbs of Taipei, are caring for the animals as best they can. But shelters have to keep their dog populations under control to prevent fights and diseases, so they desperately seek takers. This one has asked charities to adopt some of its dogs. It also encourages people from the surrounding areas to take strays home rather than buy them from pet stores.
I came to the shelter and wanted to see if there was a small dog who I'm fated to be with. We had one before, but it died from old age, so we were very sad. Now we've gotten over that sad period and wanted to see if there was an appropriate dog for us.
The animal rights charity, SPCA Taiwan, has a program to let people take care of dogs for a few months. It hopes foster families will decide to adopt. An SPCA worker is inspecting a dog being fostered by this Taipei bike shop. Shop owner Yin Mei Feng says the dog, named Little Seven, is doing well after 2 months.
On the whole, we're used to it, so we keep on caring for him. A purebred doesn't compare to raising this dog with special characteristics. You can really save money, and the dog obeys and can look after our home. Sometimes I'm in the back, and its barking sound can remind me there's a customer.
But people are still abandoning their pets, sometimes because they've grown too big for small apartments, or they are considered too costly to raise. Animal control authorities are leaving more dogs on the streets now because shelters no longer euthanize, so they are overcrowded and cannot take too many more.
It's not so easy to build a new shelter, so a lot of dogs need to live on the streets for now, except for the ones who chase cars or impact the natural environment. The ones that really need to be taken in, we give them more time to adapt to the wild.
The authorities are also neutering more strays to avoid a population explosion. Shelters might also make pet owners spend a month reconsidering whether to give up a dog. A ban on mercy killing may save the animals. But ultimately, it may take a change in pet owners' behavior to improve the animals' lives. Ralph Jennings, reporting from New Taipei City, Taiwan.
Coming up, uncertainty faces immigrants seeking U.S. citizenship. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, an erupting volcano is expected to force the population of an entire island in Vanuatu to leave for the second time in less than a year. Volcanic activity has intensified in the past week, prompting the government of the South Pacific Archipelago to declare a state of emergency. Visit VOA Asia Facebook, a fun and informative place each day to be. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a year and a half into his presidency, Donald Trump's plans for a legal immigration overhaul, including a steep reduction in family-based immigrant visas, has failed to pick up enough votes in Congress. As family members of U.S. citizens continue the long process of legally obtaining a visa, VOA's Ramon Taylor in New York tells us the question of whether the law might change worries many immigrants.
Retired and in their 70s, Ru Liangsheng and Chan Chie-Hong have spent every weekday after lunch socializing at the New York Chinese Community Center. Now that their kids are financially independent and their social benefits are stable, the two admit they are living their best lives, 28 years after moving to the U.S. through family immigrant visas. Lacking formal employment and supported financially by an older brother, the couple poured their dreams and savings into a visa application process that would take 9 years.
For the journey, for our whole family, it cost us over 10,000 Chinese yuan. In the early 1990s in China, 10,000 yuan was not a small number.
For a decade, Hong worked 7 days a week at a garment factory, while Zhang put in similar hours at a restaurant. They put three kids through college. But now their dream, acquired through family-based immigrant visas, is in jeopardy. That's because the Trump administration backs a measure that would cut legal immigration by replacing low-skilled immigrant labor with a merit-based system focusing more on jobs, career, and language skills. Proponents argued the new system would boost wages for American workers. Justin Yu, a former immigration specialized reporter who now runs the Chinese Community Center, says this is the wrong approach.
The problem of American immigration system is not the legal immigrant. It's not a family-based immigrant. It's not a merit-based immigrant. The problem of the United States immigration system is that our border has not been controlled. And that we have too many illegals, and we don't know how to do with it.
In the Chinese diaspora community, this sentiment is common, that social programs and hard-earned rights are being compromised by undocumented immigrants and some legal immigrants who take advantage of the system.
We worked and worked and worked all the way until we both retired. So if you come to the U.S. like this, that is perfectly okay. But some came and started to get immediately on welfare.
Undocumented immigrants, however, do not qualify for welfare, and legal immigrants must wait 5 years before becoming eligible for federal means-tested benefits. Wellington Chen, who runs a local development corporation in Chinatown, says cheating is rare.
I'm 99% small businesses. These people came here, didn't take away any job. If anything, they hire helpers. They put their kids through college. They work long hours. They work the jobs that no one wants to do. And they didn't ask for handouts.
A U.S.-born product of family-based immigration, Nicholas Louis' grandfather was sponsored through his own grandfather more than 60 years ago.
What's that say about the next generations when, like, there's children asking, like, where's their grandfather, you know what I mean? Or, like, where's their uncles? Why do they have no family? But everyone else seems to have, like, this wide extended family.
Louis argues the American dream shouldn't be based on financial success alone, but by how satisfied you are with what you have, including the people you love most. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
This news from VOA Asia, a landmark project mapping indigenous massacres by European settlers in Australia between 1788 and 1930, now includes 250 sites. The research team at the University of Newcastle has been contacted by hundreds of Australians, offering insights about where indigenous groups were killed. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the American Heart Association recommends eating fish at least twice a week as part of a healthy diet. And now new research shows early man probably knew about the health benefits of eating fish a long time ago. In fact, scientists are now learning what fish was the main source of protein for Stone Age people in southern Scandinavia many thousands of years ago. We digest details with VOA's Julie Tabo.
If you want to follow a truly authentic paleo diet, one based on what our earliest ancestors ate, then your focus should be on fish. Researchers at Lund University found that's exactly what Stone Age people in ancient Scandinavia were eating 10,000 years ago. They made the discovery through chemical analyses of human bones from more than 80 individuals, whose skeletons are the oldest discovered in Scandinavia.
Basically, you are what you eat. And so when you study these stable isotopes, you kind of can get an indicator of what the humans have been eating.
The study examined the importance of various protein sources in the human diet across three millennia, from around 10,500 to 7,500 years ago.
Fish kind of span between 50 or up to almost 70% of the diet. Then if you add seals and dolphins and other aquatic mammals to it, it kind of ranges between around 70% up to 100, almost 100% of the diet was just from aquatic resources.
At one settlement in Sweden, just over half of the protein intake of people came from fish, which was apparently fermented for later consumption. The data suggests what followers of paleo diets already know, that if a protein-rich regimen worked for people more than 10,000 years ago, it can still be part of a healthy lifestyle choice today. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Video games are so popular that one U.S. company is betting it can lure players to leave the comforts of gaming at home and travel to local arenas to play for bragging rights and maybe even some cash. VOA's Michelle Quinn has bragging rights on the narration.
Esports arena in Oakland, California draws gamers from all over.
As soon as I heard about it, I cleared my schedule. I joined all the games that they had to offer today.
This arena and ones like it around the world are riding the popularity of online gaming. Akin to joining a gym, members pay a monthly fee starting at $25 for unlimited play. Paul Ribera traveled 4 hours by bus and train for a chance to win $500 in the day's gaming tournament.
Headset, this is mine.
He brought his own equipment.
That and water. Stay hydrated. Hydrated is huge.
Thirst is one challenge for gamers. Most of them play at home, near the refrigerators. That's very different from this high-energy venue. But competing in person has its advantage.
I can smell the anxiety from others, the nervousness, so I just feed off of that more.
Tyler Enders co-founded Esports Arena. This is his third arena in the U.S. He's betting that other gamers once played physically near each other.
You may be antisocial, but you may have not had the opportunity to go to a place like this. That's accepting of video gamers. That's accepting of how many times and how much hours you play video games. No one cares. No one's judging.
As online gaming grows, local venues like the Esports Arena are becoming increasingly popular.
The players here like need a home right now, a strong home that's going to get our name out. And this is huge for our community. I mean, I'll know right now when I'm a grandfather, I'm going to be watching my kids competing in games.
These gamers are showing that they are willing to leave the comforts of home for the camaraderie of playing together.
Yo, you trying to join my party, bro?
Yeah.
So, normally...
Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Oakland, California.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook and, of course, on our website at voanews.com, as well as the radio. Try tuning us in if you're in the Philippines at DZUP, 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. They're in Quezon City. If you happen to be there, catch us on their radio program. We thank everyone who's tuned in there. And we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. It includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a great day.